It seems to me that in the winter there aren't quite the number of distractions that we have in the summer, naturally. I love to be outdoors like anyone else. I sail, I have a sailboat here in Marquette, and I do promise myself that when the wind blows in the summertime, I drop everything and get out on the lake. But my writing habits are a little unorthodox, I think, or I've been told so. I write in the middle of the night an awful lot. For
Wow.
years. Yeah, I won't be.
Insomniac?
Well, let's say I'm a part-time insomniac. I actually sleep very well, but I don't need as many hours as the American Medical Association
What a
recommends.
blessing.
Yes, it's almost like I have a double life or 2 days in the course of one. I tend to sleep soundly for 4, maybe 5 hours, so I'm often wide awake between 3 and 4 in the morning. And I will come and sit at my desk because I learned long ago that it really didn't make sense to lie in bed and stare at the ceiling and try to solve the problems that I can't solve. So I come and I sit and I work and I go until I'm getting tired again, which is often 2 to 3 hours later. Many times I watch the sunrise on the lake. I can see it from, it's down the hill from my house.
Oh,
I watch the
nice.
sunrise before I go back to bed. And my neighbor across the street, I had dinner with them last night, and they have 4 tiny little dogs. And when they walk the dogs early in the morning, I often wave to them as I'm going back to sleep. So, not all the time, but much of what the writing that I do is done in the dark of night, which is a time when there's no distractions, no phone rings, people aren't knocking on your door. And it works for me very well.
It does seem to work for you because I'm looking at some of your resume here. You've got the 2017 Michigan Notable Book Award for the book that we're talking about today, Wolf's Mouth. 2010, you were the Michigan Author of the Year, so something you're doing is right.
Well, I'm greatly appreciative of both of those. They've been it really it's quite an honor because there've been fine writers who've also been included in those awards.
And you're prolific. 9, 10 novels?
Well, published 10 books, 9 novels, and 1 collection of short stories. And that's, quite frankly, that's a tip of the iceberg. I have many other manuscripts that are in various forms of disarray, unfinished. Many probably will never be finished. I don't know when they will be. I have lots of other things that I have now. I used to, I'm one of those generation, I'm the generation of transitional writers, if you will. I started out writing longhand and typing things up on a manual typewriter. And then over the years, I finally sort of morphed into one of these people that I do use a computer now, but I think when I write, I think like I'm still using a pencil or a pen.
We're kindred spirits in that. I've read articles that actually writing longhand taps into some part of the creative brain a little bit better than when we use a keyboard.
Yes, I believe that that's true. I also have to say, at my age, now that I'm in my 60s, hard to believe, my hand cramps up. If I write longhand for really not too long, suddenly my hand starts to clamp up. So if I were to try to write for several hours longhand these days, it would be very difficult. So I actually appreciate the fact that a keyboard is much easier on my fingers and so forth. In the way my mind works, I still feel like I'm writing longhand across a page.
So we're talking about Wolf's Mouth at this point, your newest. Give us a synopsis of it. And it is a edge of the seat type of a book. I've very much enjoyed reading it.
Well, thank you, Zinta. In short, this is a story about a man who served in the Italian army in World War II, and he was captured in the north of Africa, and along with thousands of other European soldiers were captured by the Allies in the latter years of the war. He was brought to the United States and placed in a POW camp, which happened to be in Autran, Michigan, which is about 30 miles from Marquette. Now, this is a work of fiction. However, these camps really did exist, and there was a camp in Autran. The name of this character is Francesco Giuseppe Verdi, and he narrates the story himself, and he tells it from later in life. He's in his late 70s. So he's looking back on really the previous half century of his life, going back to when he was a young man and brought to this very alien environment in the Northwoods of Michigan. And once he's in the camp, which housed a little more than 200 men, there was a great deal of tension and conflict among the prisoners, not so much between the prisoners and the United States GIs who guarded them, but among the prisoners. And he eventually realizes that he is threatened by the German commandant, who really is the commanding officer of all the prisoners, who is very insistent that the men adhere to what I'll call a strict Nazi code. And his life is threatened, as other soldiers' lives have been threatened. And he eventually escapes, and he remains in the United States after the war. He changes his identity, he marries, he has a job, and for years he just goes along as a quote-unquote normal American. And then eventually his history catches up with him, and people emerge who know who he really is, and that leads to incidents that cause him to rethink who he has been all along. Essentially, it's about a man who has to change his whole personality to survive.
So I understand that there's just a slight thread there to your own family, your ancestors, that you made the main character the same age as your father, for instance, so that you could kind of follow who he was at what time in history and how he dressed and that kind of a thing.
I did do that, Zinta. My father, like Francesco, was born in 1919. And my father did serve in the U.S. Army in World War II. He was not a prisoner of war. The other aspects of Francesco's life really are very distinct from my father's. But in doing that, having them born in the same year, it really did allow me to think in terms of, because the story takes place over so many years, when he's in his 20s, when he's in his 30s, and when he's older, that would correspond to the way I recall my father at those points in his life, particularly in the 1950s. There's a segment of the story that takes place in Detroit in the middle 1950s. And my father was a salesman. And this is what Francesco becomes once he assumes this American persona. He changes his name from Francesco Verdi to Frank Green. Verdi means green in Italian. I think many people realize that. So in some ways, my father is a little bit out there. When I was writing the book, I was aware that that Francesco was dealing, if not with the exact same situation as my father was in, the same times. They lived through the same eras, going from the war to peacetime, post-war United States, and so forth. So it's not autobiographical, certainly, and has nothing to do directly with my father, but my recollections of my father somehow are invested in who Francesco is and how he responds to certain incidents in the book.
I'm curious, too, about some of the historic roots, the POW camps and the UP. I understand, looking at numbers, that 425,000 POW camps in the United States, and more than 2,000 of those prisoners just kind of vanished.
That's true. You know, historians don't agree on much of anything, including facts, but those figures are the ones that I encountered most commonly. Somewhere between 2,000 and 2,200 men simply were unaccounted for. Some, I think, just fell through the bureaucratic cracks. They just somehow, the paperwork got lost or something. But most of them somehow managed to not get sent back to their native country. Some of them did escape, as Francesco did, and managed to stay out of the POW camps. But others somehow just managed to not be sent back to where they came from. In my research, I encountered a number of articles that were published in the 40s, 50s, and even into the 60s, which were about incidents where men were suddenly found out to have been prisoners of war in one of these camps in the U.S. during the Second World War. And they suddenly, you know, they were married. They had jobs. In most cases, they were law-abiding citizens. And suddenly, somehow, they were found out. Somebody figured out who they were. And the U.S. government didn't quite know what to do with them. For from what I read, there really wasn't a specific law on the books that said this is what we do with men in this situation. They had been brought to the United States against their will. Many of them were married and had American wives, American children, so on and so forth. So there was not one way that they were dealt with. In many instances, they had to return to their native country, but they were allowed to rather quickly apply to return and apply for citizenship ultimately, because they had families and careers and so forth.
And the camps themselves, do they still exist? Now, in this book, without giving too much away, there is a return to the camp, and there's not much left there years and years into the future. I assume that you went to some of these places in the UP as you researched?
I did. And in fact, just this past Saturday, a group of folks here in Marquette, over about 22 people, we went on a field trip out to Autran, which is about 30 miles to the east of Marquette. Mm-hmm. And we went to the place where this camp did exist, and there is very little evidence of it. All we could find, and I had been there years ago, but all we could find was one concrete slab, and we weren't sure whether this had been part of a building or perhaps it had been showers. We didn't know. There were a number of holes that had clearly been dug in the ground where we assumed refuse had been buried. The only real evidence of the camp was in one hole there were a number of broken plates, porcelain plates, and a few tin cups and bowls, which were very rusted and sort of flattened. That was the only evidence of some of the items that they may have used during the camp. My understanding is that most of the other camps around the country, they don't exist. The buildings have long ago been torn down. This isn't one of the chapters in American history that we tend to want to remember and to, you know, honor with some kind of, you know, museums and so forth.
It was interesting to me when I was reading this that it's not the guards, the people overseeing the camps, but in this case, this Nazi group of soldiers that really are the wardens. They're the ones who run the place. How factual is that?
This rather took me by surprise. When I really started to read about these camps, this wasn't in just one or two camps. Historians tend to disagree, but there were approximately 170 camps throughout the United States. And in a great number of them, this often happened where a small percentage of the soldiers who considered themselves to be ardent Nazis, and the Americans often called those soldiers true believers, they felt it was their responsibility to make sure that all the men in the camp adhered to this, you know, strict Nazi code. And behave in a certain fashion. And there was resistance. And there were instances where to maintain this order, men were threatened, men were beaten, and really quite severely injured. There were deaths that resulted. And one of the more persuasive methods was that, you know, the soldiers had they were allowed to send mail back to their homelands on a limited basis, and everything was reviewed by the Americans, but they could write home. And they would tell men who really weren't willing to conform to their expectations, we know where your family lives back in Germany or Austria or wherever, and we will send a message back to people who could make life very difficult for them. So there were various forms of persuasion. And this, as I say, this was not something that occurred in one or two camps. It was prevalent really throughout the camps across the United States.
As we look at your entire body of work, I understand that some of your other books are being reissued as paperbacks, which I think will add to their popularity. Talk about that. Also, I believe you have a sequel coming out to Cold.
Yes. You know, I published my first novel 30 years ago, which gives me pause. But it also means that, you know, it has allowed me time to produce a number of books. And I've been fortunate that some of them have been published. I've worked with various publishers, commercial publishers in New York and so forth. Mm-hmm. I feel extremely fortunate that now I'm working with Michigan State University Press. You know, books have a shelf life. almost, you can almost say that the shelf life is often not much longer than fresh vegetables. Books go out of print, and this is happening even more rapidly now that we're moving into a time when there are options to a physical book. There's ebooks, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
I feel very fortunate not only to be working with Michigan State University Press, but the fact that they are willing to reissue books of mine that were published a number of years ago. This year, they have already reissued three titles, Cold and Firepoint, two books which are set here in the Upper Peninsula, and then a book which is set back in the Boston area where I grew up, which is called The Invisible World. And at the end of the year, they're going to publish another historical novel called The Anarchist. So many books go out of print, and there's never a hope of seeing them returned to being in print as, you know, physical books. So I feel really very fortunate that this is happening. It means that the books are also going to be available as ebooks and as audiobooks in
Nice.
The years to come. Yes.
So give us a little tease here. What is out?
Cold came out in 2001, and it is set here in the central part of the Upper Peninsula in the Marquette County area. And this new book is called Out. I call it a sort of sequel, because only one character from the previous book returns quite a bit later in his life. And the title Out comes from a local usage of the word. When I first moved up here, I taught at Michigan State for 11 years before coming up to Northern Michigan University.
Hmm.
When I first got here, one of the words that people used in a different way was the word out. And it meant they were referring to someone who lived outside of Marquette. Now, Marquette is surrounded by the woods on one side and Lake Superior on the other side. And, you know, we have all the modern conveniences here, so on and so forth. But you only have to drive a handful of miles out into the woods, and things are very different. And there are people who choose to live, whether it's 6 or 16 miles out. They're not always completely off the grid, but they really are in a very different environment, and locals just refer to them as living out. So this is a story about a man who has chosen after many years to live out, and there is yet again another fierce blizzard, which there was one in Cold. And during one night when his house is being battered by this blizzard, a number of people arrive who are seeking shelter.
Oh, that's fascinating. I may have to bring you back in 2018.
I'd be happy to.
I have a special love for the UP. I lived up in the Keweenaw for a while, and it's just a wonderful area to return to.
I know. I just returned from there yesterday. I was in Copper Harbor for 3 days, and I gave a reading and a talk at the library in Calumet Wednesday night. And we have so many beautiful roadways in this
yes.
state. But some of the best views along the coast and so forth are in the Keweenaw Peninsula.
Agreed.
Whether you're going in the hills above the lake or right along the lake shore, it's every turn is a new postcard. It's just spectacular.
It is. So you mentioned that you've taught at MSU, most recently at Northern Michigan University, but you've also been at Western Michigan University.
I did. Back when I was at Michigan State, I went for 3 years running, and I believe it was 1993 to 1995, I taught in the graduate writing program as sort of a visiting writer. I would teach one graduate fiction workshop each year, usually in the winter semester. So there was one night a week during that semester when I would drive from East Lansing over to Kalamazoo, usually listening to audiobooks in my car. And I still, matter of fact, just recently I was doing a reading at a library down near Detroit, and one of my students from those years arrived with his teenage daughter. It was wonderful to see him. That was the first time that I was in a situation where I was teaching graduate students in a creative writing program. And it really gave me a taste of it. And when the job for a fiction writer opened up here at Northern Michigan University, I really wanted to do this. And when I came up here and I saw the lake
yeah.
right on the edge of town, I was sold.
Now I'm wondering, what is that most important lesson that you teach for writers? You've referred to the writing experience as an out-of-body experience, a form of
yes.
prayer, or even a disease with no cure, and it's fatal. I love that.
And all that applies.
What is the most important lesson that you found yourself teaching to young writers?
You know, I wish I had like the 10 golden rules to be successful in a writer's life. And quite frankly, it's impossible to answer this succinctly. If I get one message across, it's don't give up. And that may sound simple, but in some ways for a writer, it's the hardest thing. There are so many things going against you, the currents of the times and the depth and range of rejection that all writers have to deal with. It makes you want to quit. I mean, it just seems like this is it's not going to work out for you, and why are you putting yourself through this? So you really have to dig down to a very deep, special place that tells you you're not going to be the same person unless you continue on. I hope that gets through to most of my students. I hear from my students going back many years with some regularity, and their lives have, thrown all sorts of unexpected things at them, of course. But for the most part, they're still writing, and I think that that's something that is at the center of who they have been, who they have become since they were working with me. So it's a simple message, but I hope it's one that they carry long after they've actually been dealing with me.
You know, it's interesting. When I've asked many writers over the years what their most important lesson would, I would say that's probably the most common answer: persistence. It's not just
Absolutely.
talent, but you've got to persist.
No, talent, I don't want to, there's a place for it. And I suppose one of us, sometimes we can think in terms of a muse and so forth. It's the hard work of sitting in a chair at a table or a desk and putting in the time. When I would start a workshop, a lot of times in workshops, the instructor will insist that you try to produce a certain number of words within a given time period, one writing session or one day. And I tell my students, don't count words, because you'll as you're writing, you're just thinking about producing a certain number of words. Rather than words, think in terms of time. Tell yourself that today you're going to sit down for 45 minutes, or you're going to sit down for an hour and 15 minutes, or even 2 hours, and stay there. And whether you produce 100 words or 500 words or one sentence, what's important is that you remain at the task for a specific period of time. I think in some ways that frees us up from thinking in terms of, oh, I just have to keep producing and producing. Because writing isn't just physically writing words down. There's an awful lot else that goes on. Just sitting here staring at a blank page or a blank screen, that all contributes to the final result.
Good advice, John. Thank you.
I hope so.
Well, thank you so much. I hope we'll speak again.
Zinta, this has been an awful lot of fun.